This is the Craig Folly Show on WDET. Thank you very much for being with me today. Now, back in 1986, author Andy Hoffman quit his engineering job and also declined acceptances to some very prestigious grad school programs and instead said, "I want to be a carpenter." Now, 25 years later, he's written a book about it. It's called Builder's Apprentice. It's by Andrew Hoffman, a memoir, and he joins me right now. Andrew, welcome to the Craig Folly Show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, this is a remarkable story when you take a look at this. You know, you're not the only person, obviously, to pursue a dream. But when you look at the choice that you made, giving up an opportunity to go to a very prestigious graduate school program at Harvard, Berkeley had accepted you as well. Instead, you decided to become a carpenter. And we'll get into why you made that decision in just a second. But I'm always intrigued by perhaps the social ramifications of a decision like that. Was this a situation where you had a lot of people just saying, "What are you thinking?"
Yes, absolutely. And you can begin with my parents. I mean, I was 24 when I did this, or 26 when I did this, and to sit down with your parents and say you're not going to Harvard or Berkeley, you're going to be a carpenter on Nantucket, was a very difficult conversation. But I had to quit my job. My boss didn't understand what I was doing, and a lot of friends didn't understand what I was doing, but many did. Many were very supportive. It was a provocative decision, but that made it all the more exciting.
You know, it's interesting. When I mentioned the sort of the social cost of this, I was speaking to a man not too long ago who's got a couple of different PhDs and spends his time welding. And a number of people, he says he'll go to cocktail parties and people ask him what he does and he'll tell them and they just sort of assume that he's not, you know, mentally fit for the conversation that they're about to embark upon. Is that the type of a situation you find yourself in at times?
Well, I did. When my first carpentry job was in Nantucket, and I found myself socializing with people that used to be my peer group in Boston, you know, engineers, architects, managers, and when I told them I was a carpenter, I found that they treated me differently. That was a startling surprise. I didn't expect that.
And these are people you already knew?
No, I'm talking about people
that
I met. You know, the people that I knew still knew who I was, but the new people I met saw me differently.
Well, and how so?
Just the conversations would take a different tone. I mean, I would meet people in restaurants or in bars in Nantucket and would find that my sort of social group that they compared me with was the manual labor of Nantucket, not the professionals who came there on vacation.
Even though you had probably as much, if not more, education than they did.
Yes. I was I had a bachelor's in chemical engineering. I hadn't yet gotten a graduate degree.
It's just a weird situation that type of a decision can create. I mean, when you went into this, did you have any idea that that's the type of thing that might happen?
No, I didn't. I was just, you know, I was young and I was just following a gut. When I got those acceptance letters to Harvard and Berkeley, I just froze. There was something wrong. I just didn't feel right. And listened to that frozen gut, had helped a friend build a deck, got a charge out of it, answered an ad in the paper for carpenters on Nantucket, and flew down and accepted the job.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's neat about this is, you know, you, of course, you start on this journey to become a carpenter, end up being a builder, and something you said is that's a distinction you didn't even know existed at the time. At what point did it dawn on you that you could take this to a different place?
Well, when I started to take over in the job of supervising some of these very large projects, 13,000 square feet, 29,000 square feet, I started to associate with the role. And I would find myself in that circumstance meeting people, going to parties, and they would ask what I did. And now I would start to say I'm a builder, and I fully identified with the role. And started to feel differently and very confident in that role, too. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it almost seems, too, that at that point, Andy, that, you know, when you say that I'm a builder, all of a sudden your engineering background, all the things that you've studied really come to play in this new role that you have.
Yes and no. I mean, the beauty of doing this was that, let me begin by saying I had a boss and a mentor who guided me through it, so that was critically important. I was basically his student. But a lot of it I was just figuring out. And that's what was tremendously exciting to me, is that we go to school, we learn how to be an engineer, we go into a job, and we apply those skills. Here, I was figuring it out on my own, how to make the job run, how to make the contractors get along, how to coordinate them, get the materials, and so forth. And that was that creative element to it I found thrilling.
My guest right now is Andy Hoffman. He's a professor in the School of Business and also in the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. And he's also just penned a new memoir called Builder's Apprentice, which basically takes us through his decision early in his life to forsake continuing his education in engineering at Harvard or Berkeley and instead becoming an apprentice to a builder. And, you know, one of the things that's neat about this, though, is that in this book, you really go through sort of the social hierarchy almost of a job site and really sort of study the relationships between people, the way the older workers mesh together with the new ones, how they got them into the fold and got them thinking the right way. You almost looked at this from sort of a social science perspective.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that was intentional. I do teach organizational behavior here at the University of Michigan at the business school. But really what I learned that building houses is, of course, about the materials and the structure, but it's very much about people. And my ability to turn one way and speak to a carpenter, another way to talk to the engineer and the architect, and another way to talk to the multimillionaire owner was a skill that I didn't know I had, but did, and the ability to speak in the language and understand the issues of each of those. That was the critical skill necessary to get this job done.
Yeah,
trust was everything.
And is it the kind of skill that you can learn in a classroom?
That's a great question. I just finished writing an essay for Harvard Business Review, and I bring this question up because so many of the things that come out in the book, the issues like trust. Trust is critically important, and you can look at somebody's resume, but you have to meet them, and you have to feel it in your gut. And that's hard to teach in the classroom, but I think that we can, as educators of management, start to think about how we deliver management education differently so that it is less strictly defined in the classroom and has a lot more experience to it. And here at the Ross School, we do a lot of that.
And, you know, sometimes, though, it does take being out in the quote-unquote real world, giving people that perspective. We're seeing it right now with this TV show where the boss goes down to work with the lower-level employees of these companies. Is this the kind of training that you would like to see more business students get?
I think more students across the board. Yes, I think business students should have more experience in the real world where the stakes are higher, where the consequence of decisions is higher so that they can really feel what it's like. But a theme that came up throughout the story and my experience was also that all the people in the trades really felt that architects should spend time in the trades to really see what it's like to do the physical aspects of building a house so that they would
sure.
influence their design decisions.
Well, you know, one of the things that you also say in this book, and I thought this was just a great line from his, a life well lived must be a creative endeavor. Mm-hmm. We don't often think about that when it comes to building something like a house.
Oh, yeah. And I think about that more in terms of what we do with our lives. I mean, the book is about building houses, but it's also about following your creative impulses and following your dream. And I see so many students that struggle to do that. They start to build their resume from like eighth grade and go forward. And once you buy into that the resume is the most important, then you're buying into the notion that the measure of the quality of your life is measured by somebody else. And the important lesson here in this book is that you should follow your own path. You should figure out what that is first, but then you follow your own path, your own measure of what a life well lived is. And then it will become creative by definition.
Andy Hoffman, my guest right now, his new memoir, Builder's Apprentice, and he, of course, is a professor at the University of Michigan in the Ross School of Business. Now, taking a look at this, though, you mentioned that creativity, finding your own path in life. At what point in your career did you determine that it was time to impart some of those lessons that you had learned? Because, you know, you could continue following on your path, and right now I know you're working on restoring a house, but talk about that. At what point did you decide that this is something you needed to tell other people?
Well, when I did this, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of people were incredulous. But then as I started to do it, a lot of people took it as inspiration that they should do the same thing in their lives, that if one person can do this, they can do this. And I'm always fascinated by people who take these radical right turns in their life and suddenly at whatever point, whether it's at retirement or at 25, recognize, you know, this is somebody else's life and I want to live my own. So through that experience, I would share that. But then as I became a professor and saw more students struggling with this question of what do they want to do with their lives, and seeing so many succumb to the peer pressure that can exist, the pressures for conformity in the university or grad school, I find more and more I want to move in this direction to really help students explore what it is they really want to do in order to make their life a much more fulfilling and satisfying one.
Well, you mentioned the pressures of conformity, and we talked at the beginning of this interview about some of the social pressures that you found yourself under as a result of the decision that you made. Is this something that every person is capable of doing, or does some just, you know, automatically succumb to that pressure?
Well, I think for some people, the idea of having a career that is more personal is an individual thing. I mean, some people are perfectly fine just a job that provides money because their passions lie elsewhere, whether it's providing for their family or whatever it may be. There's no one way to do this. The important thing is, are you doing it the way you want to do it, and then stick to it, and that's where it's meant to be.
So, Andy, I guess the question is, you know, once you put all this down on paper, the book has just been published. In fact, it's going to be released, I believe, next month by Huron River Press.
That's great.
And I've got an advanced copy of it and been reading it. It really is a great read. But what did you get out of actually writing the book?
Oh, this is a very important personal accomplishment for me. I've written 7 other books. I've written about 80 articles. And they're of the academic variety. And so
this one's about you, though, which may be a little harder.
Yes, those others are about what I know and what I can prove. This is about what I believe. And to me, getting through life, what you believe is very much more important than what you can prove. And so this book is very much a personal statement about things I believe, and that's why I find it just so tremendously satisfying to get this out.
Well, it's a great read, by the way. And
thank you very much.
I recommend anybody that's thinking about having a house built going through this to get a better sense of what it is they're going to be dealing with throughout the process, because you do get a little glimpse onto life on a job site, which is invaluable as well. I think everybody should get a little taste of what that's about. But Andy Hoffman, again, author of Builder's Apprentice, a memoir, also a professor in the Ross School of Business and the Natural Resources and Environment College at the University of Michigan. Thanks for your time. It really is a great read.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And this is the Craig Folly Show on WDET. And we're going to wrap up today talking a little bit about a unique fundraising opportunity for the Shelter Association of Washtenaw County. There's a new music poster taking a look back at the illustrious history of the Second Chance Ballroom, now known as the Nectarine Ballroom. My guest, Diana Nearing. She's the Director of Development for the Shelter Association of Washtenaw County, and also Dick Siegel, legendary Ann Arbor musician who happens to have brought his guitar. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great being here, Craig.
And Dick, we're going to hear from you in just a second because, one, you're on this poster, which is important to talk about. So you obviously have a connection with the Second Chance and the Nectarine Ballroom. And also, you're going to play for us in just a little bit. But, Diana, I want to start with you, first of all. The idea of this poster as a fundraising vehicle, where did it come from, first of all?
Well, John Carver, who was the man behind the Second Chance and the Nectarine Ballroom, is a friend of one of our board members. And he wanted to produce this as, just to memorialize the whole experience of the Second Chance and Nectarine Ballroom. And so he came to our board member and said he would like the Shelter Association to be the beneficiary of the sales. And so we, got a small committee together of volunteers and worked to put this together. A man named John Griffith did the design work, and I think he did a stunning job. So we produced 1,182, which was the number of people that could come in at the height of the Second Chance. And so those are...
So that was capacity of the bar.
That was capacity,
okay.
Right. And that was before the fire marshal reduced it.
Yeah, which usually happens.
They did come in and change that. But so they're hand numbered, and that's all there are, and they're pretty stunning posters.
Well, what's amazing to me is when you look at this, you get a sense of just how many people have played there over the course of, what, 35 years
right.
of history in here. And Dick Siegel, to be included on this poster, has got to be pretty significant when you look at some of the people that are on here. And I'm just looking at it across from me right now. B.B. King is on here. Ricky Nelson, Neville Brothers.
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder what happened to that Muhammad Ali show. What was that all about?
He had a great band. He was doing... I'm kidding.
Seriously. I wonder if he did like Float Like a Butterfly, Sting Like a Bee, because he did do a musical version of that. I remember.
Well, maybe that's what it was. But,
Mitch Ryder, Joan Jett, Yorma was there, Bob Seger, of course, Commander Cody, and everybody, even new people like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, newer people, I should say. So for you to be included on this, I mean, you are an Ann Arbor legend. Was it a big deal?
Sure. It's very nice. Very nice. And by the way, actually, the guy that designed the poster's name is Mike Griffin.
Oh, did I say Griffith?
You said John Griffith.
Mike. Yeah,
you conflated the two names, John Carver, Mike Griffin. Yeah, but Mike Griffin
did the
poster. And actually, I was looking at it, and just looking at all the amazing people that perform there and thinking what a nice thing that would be in someone's living room who's into any one of the many, many groups that have played at the Second Chance.
It's a
very cool poster.
What's great about it, too, from a music fan standpoint, you've got just as much local talent on this poster as you do national talent that was coming through, which just shows you the wide range of people that were getting booked. It seems that it was about quality.
Right. Quality and variety.
And obviously, you got a chance to play there.
Sure.
What is it about this ballroom that worked for you?
What was it about? It was a great showcase place. It was unusual in Ann Arbor. It was huge for Ann Arbor, and it had a big stage, a very kind of national class high stage with a great sound system, and the fact that there were so many wonderful groups that came through there, it was always a pleasure to play there myself.
You also saw shows there.
Saw shows, right.
And I'm going to assume, Diana, that you maybe have seen a show or two here
yourself.
I have seen
a show or two, yes.
Well, tell me about a couple of memorable ones for you. I mean, it may not have been somebody huge that stands out to you, but for you, Dick, I mean, talk about your earliest memory over
well,
there.
Well, the one show that really stands out in my mind is I saw Junior Walker.
Wow.
There, Junior Walker and the
All-Stars. With the All-Stars, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And as far as I was concerned, he was in his prime. And I found myself, and being a performer myself, I don't go out that much to see shows, at places like that. I don't see that many concerts, which is too bad. But anyway, I made an exception, and I went to see Junior Walker because I always loved him. And I was on the floor watching, and all of a sudden I realized that my mouth was open and I was yelling. I was yelling, because everything he did was just, it just moved me so much. So that's one of my most wonderful experiences as an audience member, and it was at the Second Chance.
So this place.
Thanks, John Carver, for.
This place obviously then has pretty deep ties to the community, and a number of people from all over Southeast Michigan have very, very fond memories. Obviously, Diana, you're hoping to capitalize on some of that nostalgia. You got $50 a piece for these, correct?
Yes, right.
And the proceeds for it go to benefit your organization. Tell us just a little bit about what you do, first of all.
Well, the Shelter Association, we really focus on Washtenaw County. Our clients are men and women who are single, 18 and over. And these people have, by some extraordinary thing that's happened in their lives, found themselves to be without a home. And one of the things that we know is that about a third of the people we see are homeless for the first time, so we try to get them, back into housing as quickly as possible. Another third are finding themselves homeless for the second or third time, and we only have about a third of the population that is chronically homeless. We have a number of excellent programs, and some of our clients come and actually find temporary shelter, and we do intensive case management to remove the barriers that they have to finding housing, which, of course, the biggest barrier today is finding a job so that they can actually afford housing. And, this economy, and especially in Michigan, it's just not going away, and we're seeing more and more people. Last year, we saw about 1,200 people come through, and this year we're looking at probably 1,500 or more. So it's a growing population, unfortunately. We also have services that are for non-residents. We have a free clinic. People can come in and get housing help. They can get help with their benefits. A lot of people don't know how to get through the maze of, like, the Social Security, finding their benefits. So we have people, professionals, you know, who really can help these people. And in the winter, and where it's just ending now, we have what's called a rotating shelter, and we have 24 congregations, faith-based congregations, who two faith-based congregations a week open their doors to 25 men and women each.
Okay.
So that we really expand the number of people we can serve in the winter, because, you know, Michigan winters, you don't want to be on the street, you don't want to be in a tent, you don't want to be, you know, under in your car or under a bridge. So we have, you know, a very strong volunteer community. I mean, Ann Arbor is pretty remarkable for that. Actually, it's all of Washtenaw County. It's not just Ann Arbor, to tell you the truth.
Well, absolutely. And you know, this, again, is just a great way. This poster is a great way for people to get involved in this.
Yes.
And perhaps to think about, you know, just the musical legacy of this area, and, of course, of the Second Chance, now the Nectarine Ballroom. Dick Siegel with us once again. And Dick, we want you to play, because you are on the poster. So technically, you are, you know, an Ann Arbor legend now, officially.
Being on the poster.
You're linked to immortality here.
Right,
I mean,
frankly, well, actually, I am anyway.
I mean, just
by virtue of being mortal.
Of course. But we want you to play for us here.
Okay.
What are we
going to
hear?
Yeah, this is a newish song. It's called "Thank God for the Little Things."
Fitting for now.
Actually, it's kind of apropos to this whole subject.
Absolutely.
Sometimes I struggle with the morning, looking at another day. Worries crowding up the picture, pushing hopes and dreams away. Then I have a cup of coffee, enjoy the pleasure it brings. Then I read the morning paper, and I thank God for the little things. This house is kind of modest, we did most of it ourselves. It took a lot to make it pretty, we worked hard, you can tell. We don't drive latest models, you don't wear big diamond rings, but what we need, honey, we got it. Thank God for the little things. Thank God for the little things, like having heat, enough to eat, friends we like to share our time with. They help us, we help them, our family, the garden, the sun, the moon, the stars above. We're still in love, thank God for the little things. Both of us are much too busy, sometimes work is such a drain. Then I think we got it easy, shake my head and I don't complain. So much trouble in this big world, who knows what's waiting in the wings. With all I've got to make me happy, I say thank God for the little things. Thank God for the little things, like having heat, enough to eat, friends we like to share our time with. They help us, we help them, our family, the garden, the sun, the moon, the stars above. We're still in love, thank God for the little things. Thank God for the little things, like having heat, enough to eat, friends we like to share our time with. They help us, we help them, our family, the garden, the sun, the moon, the stars above. Still in love, thank God for the little things. Thank God for the little things. Thank God for the little things.
Dick Siegel. on the Craig Folly Show here on WDET. A new song, and a wonderful song it is, and very fitting for the subject matter here and what we're talking about right now. And you're, of course, a longtime friend of WDET, been playing here for years, and just one of the many, many people who appear on this new poster, and of course, for the Second Chance and now the Nectarine Ballroom. Again, this poster goes to benefit really the homeless in Washtenaw County. The Shelter Association of Washtenaw County has teamed up with John Carrer, the former owner of the Second Chance Nectarine Ballroom, for this poster. $50 is the donation?
Yes,
okay,
it is.
And they can donate more if they want to, right?
Absolutely. And some people do, actually.
Well, if somebody wants to do this, I mean, we have to give them an opportunity on how to do it.
Right. Right now, we're selling them online. So you go to our webpage, which is AnnArborShelter.org, and it's very clear once you get there, you know, how you can purchase it, and you know, put your credit card information in, then we send it off to you.
Well,
so,
and I highly recommend people to go to the website just to check it out, because I cannot describe it very well on the radio.
Right, right.
And I should also remind folks, I'm talking to Diana Nearing. She's the development director of the Shelter Association of Washtenaw County, joining us here. And I really thank you both for being here. This is a great project. And boy, what a legacy, Dick, this place has. When you look at it, Diana, one of the things that I thought was neat about this is you actually got one of the curators from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to take a look at this. What was
Absolutely.
The reaction?
Well, one of the things that he said about the Second Chance in Nectarine Ballroom is that there's never been a venue anywhere in the United States that has had the variety of musicians come through. So it's not just rock and roll. It's not just jazz. It's not just local. It's just the breadth of the entertainment world. And really, there's just a sampling of all the acts on this poster, and it's just jam-packed with names. So he was really quite impressed, and actually gave us a quote for the press release, which
well,
we were very pleased.
And it was really neat to take a look at it. But, you know, hey, any place that has the meat puppets along with Bob Ufer, the former voice of Michigan football, you know, yeah, obviously they're open to all different kinds of things. But I really appreciate you both being with us today. It's a really worthwhile project. Thanks. Hey,
thank you very much.
Once again, Diana Nearing and Dick Siegel joining me here on the Craig Folly Show on WDET. And this is WDET Detroit, Wayne State's public radio station. Have a great day.